Hi, good afternoon. Welcome to Advanced Features in Silverlight 5. I'm Nick Kramer, Senior Program Manager with the Silverlight team. Just wanted to say thanks for coming out. I hope you guys have had a great mix. It's been a real excited time for me. I'm always really excited to be able to come and talk to you guys. It's really great to write software, but it's even better to get to see and meet the people who actually use it. So thanks for coming out, and thanks for coming to the session. So we got a bunch of different things to cover today. This is kind of the grab bag talk of the day. We get to cover all the features that didn't fit anywhere else in our other sessions. There is a little bit of a unifying theme here. A lot of these features are related by being features for trusted applications. So the first five or so bullets are going to follow that theme. But to hold that all together, I have a little Silverlight insurance demo. How many of you guys attended Steve Lasker's talk, which was, what do you call it, building in-browser applications for Silverlight? All right, so a lot of hands here. You've seen this application already. I'll just, for those of you who haven't seen it yet, I'll do a really quick walkthrough of what we got here. And we have, what I'm showing here is basically a Silverlight 4 application that we'll now add some Silverlight 5 features to take it to the next level. So imagine you're an insurance adjuster for Silverlight Insurance. Silverlight Insurance insures automobiles. It's a slightly different insurance company than you may be used to. Instead of insuring individuals, it actually insures car dealerships. So when the car dealer is in a hurry to take all those cars off the truck and park them in its lot as tightly as it can, sometimes they back it up a little bit too far and they get a ding, and then they call Silverlight Insurance to fix their car up for them. So an insurance adjuster, he's got a calendar of appointments. And on any given day, he drives out to dealership number one. He opens up the particular claim. Usually the claim isn't quite right. It's not Joe Bob, it's Joe Bob's cars. Then he'll go through that. He'll go to the damage report. You know, this car, I don't know, maybe let's get in a really big accident here. We can check off every panel we got. And as part of this, one of the fun parts here is he gets to add photos for the car. And if you do this enough times, so Silverlight 4 and Silverlight 3 and even Silverlight 2 had the open file dialog, where you can pop open the dialog and the user can pick which files they want to get to. And that's a decent way to do it if you're doing this once or twice, but if you're doing this all day long, just uploading folders, uploading file after file after file, it gets to be a little tedious. Your insurance adjuster is doing this all day long, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year. It would be great if we could just take those photos right off a USB drive, detect that we inserted a USB drive, slurp those files right up without having to do any dialogues, any searching through the directory structure. So we're going to take advantage of some Silverlight 5 features to build that out. And the first feature that we're going to want to know about in order to build that experience is the Silverlight Insurance demo. Now, after that, first feature that we'll want to know about is what we call unrestricted file access. So your Silverlight 4 sandboxed application could only access files in isolated storage. Your Silverlight 4 trusted application could access some other files on the hard drive. They could access documents, music, pictures, videos. But there was a lot of places on the hard drive they couldn't access files. Couldn't access files off C:\. Couldn't access files from a network share, you know, /, some computer name, /, whatever. And of course, Silverlight 4 couldn't access stuff off the USB drive because, again, that's not under documents, music, pictures, or video. In Silverlight 5, we lift that restriction. It's as simple as we got to hit the delete key a bunch of times to make a better product. I love it when it's that simple. And let's put that into practice here. So we go inside the claim view model. The damages page, claim view model, gets to span a couple different views, one of the benefits of an MVVM architecture. And so let's just check out what we already have here. When the user clicks that hyperlink to add files, to open new photos, they're ultimately calling this function that just adds photos from dialog. And it does, you know, your standard Silverlight 2, really, thing. It calls the open file dialog, it sets dialog filter, multi-select, sure, whatever. Then it loops through each of the files that you opened, and ultimately it calls this function, add photo from stream. We don't really want any of that except maybe this last line that calls add photo from stream. Instead of getting it from the open file dialog, let's get it off USB. So let's start by adding a new function. Instead of add photos from dialog, let's do add photos from path. Pass in a path and rearrange your code by accident. Let's just call the standard system.io methods. So system.io namespace has a class called directory. Directory has a nice little function to enumerate all the files in that directory. And then we also use system.io, the path, to make sure that it's actually a JPEG file. We don't really want to upload movies or anything else. We just want JPEGs in this particular application. And then we just do file.openread. It's, again, your standard system.io method to open files. And then we'll pass it back to that add photo from stream method earlier. And so now we have a nice little method that will take files out of any given directory, and we need to find a line of code to call that method. So just to make sure that we know exactly what demo we're running, let's delete the old thing. Let's get rid of all that dialog stuff. And let's just add some code. And just so I can show the unrestricted file access, let's just hard code in a path. And this is, you know, something off C:\. It's not something Silverlight 4 can access. It's obviously not a USB drive either, but you know, one step at a time. And when we hit F5 here, we are going to load up the page and go where we were. And we're going to find out that there's actually one thing missing here. And just for dramatic effect, drum roll please, security exception. So there is one missing word, or one important word I had in the earlier slide there, which was trusted apps can get unrestricted file access. What we have right now is a sandboxed app. A random web page shouldn't have access to your hard drive, and that's the same way in Silverlight. If you want access to the hard drive, you need to be a trusted application. How do you do that? Silverlight 4 had the concept of trusted applications that were out of browser. If you wanted to be a trusted application, you had to run out of browser, and you had to be installed with user consent. When the user installs your application, they say, yep, he's a trustworthy dude, I will trust his application. Silverlight 5 builds on that and adds the notion of an in-browser trusted application with administrator consent. And the model here is that the administrator will set permissions using group policy saying which applications can do which things, which applications are trusted, and implicitly by which applications they don't list, which applications are not trusted and need to run in the sandbox. It's a model that's very web-like. There's no prompts. There's no, would you like to install this web page? That doesn't really make sense. There's no, do you trust this web page? No, it's a web page. Web pages do what web pages do. It's your familiar web-based navigation model. You navigate to a URL, and there's your page. And it can be part of a larger HTML site. Your Silverlight in-browser trusted app can be part of a larger HTML5 or ASP.NET site. It's a great way to leverage your existing assets without having to rewrite everything from scratch just because you wanted a trusted piece. And just a quick rundown for those who haven't spent a lot of time in Silverlight trusted apps. There's a bunch of features that haven't really changed here. It's the same prompt-free experience as Silverlight 4. We don't pop up prompts saying, would you like to trust this application to use the clipboard? Would you like to trust this application to go full screen mode? Would you trust this application to increase isolated storage? Answer to all this is, yes, I trusted the app. Why are you asking me again? And we don't. There's also cross-domain networking. Trusted apps can access cross-domain networking files without needing a client access policy file. Again, that's similar to SL4. Full-screen keyboard mode, you can use all 101 keys on the keyboard in full-screen mode, unlike a sandboxed application. Trusted apps in browser or out of browser have access to COM. And some new things in Silverlight 5, we talked about the unrestricted file access. Pinvoke we'll cover in a little bit, and run in browser is our favorite trusted feature. The process for creating a trusted app is really simple. It's if you've ever created a trusted out-of-browser app, it is, in the beta at least, it is literally exactly the same process. It's probably a little too exactly the same API, if you ask me. You actually, to create an in-browser trusted app, you go into the out-of-browser settings, a little weird, and set the elevated permissions equals required. That's the magic. Post beta, we're going to change where this little blob is, but it's going to be like in browser settings, elevated permissions equal required. So if you're trying it in the beta, that's what you'll be looking for. And the second part of creating a trusted in-browser application, first you have to ask for trust. Second is you have to sign your Zap, because the signature, that AuthentiCode signature, is going to be what the administrator is trusting. You give the application a certificate. The admin says, "I trust applications with that certificate." There you go. And the process here is, again, exactly the same as it was for Silverlight 4 trusted apps. You can do it in Visual Studio. There's a nice little page in VS. You can also do it at the command line if you're that kind of person. And we'll show you in Visual Studio. So let's try that out. So let's close this one out here. Let's just stop debugging. We now know what the problem is. And let's make this a trusted application. You can do this more than one way. Let's go into Solution Explorer. Let's right-click on our project. Go down to Properties. Our Silverlight tab. And this is where it gets a little weird in the beta. To create an in-browser thing, you got to click Enable Running Out of Browser. That's the only way you can get that little XML blob into our manifest file. And now my favorite part of the demo. The monitor is a little different here. On the other monitor I tried, the magic checkbox we needed was actually just off the bottom of the screen. I was wondering how I was going to demo that. Enable out of browser, check the required elevated trust thing. And now we have an elevated app that can also run in browser as well as out of browser. There's one other little gotcha you're going to want to know if you try this at home. When you check this checkbox, Visual Studio helpfully suggests that you change your default startup project. It will automatically change my default startup project from the website to the Silverlight app, the ASP.NET site versus the Silverlight part of it. I don't really like that suggestion. I really want that web page. I wanted that in-browser experience. So I'm going to go back and change the startup project back to the website. But if you get a really funny-looking error message, that's probably what happened. You forgot to change it back. Now we're going to check this out, and we're going to now have access to those files off /demo/pictures or whatever it was. And no dialogues, no prompts. Click the button, pictures are loaded. So that was the developer side of this. Actually, I forgot one important thing here. If you were paying attention, I said you had to do two things. Make it in an elevated trust app and sign it. Did anyone notice I didn't sign it? All right, so I cheated a little bit. There's actually two cases here. You can sign your app or you can run it off localhost. Localhost is special. For the same thing we did in Silverlight 4, if you run off localhost, we basically pretend as if the application was properly signed. And this is just to make the Visual Studio experience easier to do. Otherwise, you're hitting F5 and you go, you didn't sign your app yet. Are you sure you want to debug this evil app that you just wrote? No one wants to deal with that, so we just special case localhost. So the signing thing looks like this. Check this checkbox and select a certificate. You can 3 or 4 different places on the machine to look for certificates. And this is just your standard AuthentiCode certificate. You buy it from VeriSign. You can generate your own certificate, since really the only thing that matters here is that you and the administrator agree on the certificate, so it doesn't even need to be a certificate you bought from an outside certificate authority. You can just make up your own certificate. But again, I'm just going to run this in VS so I can do the localhost thing here. Let's just talk a little bit about that group policy stuff for the administrator side. I said the administrator could set permissions. I guess that's true in a general sense. There's really only one permission to set, and that's, is this publisher trusted or not? Really simple model, trusted, not trusted. That's the nice binary decision there. And the way we'd specify this is through certificates. The administrator says, here is the list of certificates. Any app signed with that certificate, I trust. Any app that's not signed with one of these 5 certificates, I do not trust. And it works exactly the same way that ClickOnce works. There's a trusted publisher store. It is the same trusted publisher store, the same parts of the trusted publisher store that you'd use for a ClickOnce application. So you're a lot of administrators are already going to be familiar with how to do the cert magic. They can use certmanager.exe. They can use the group policy magic to get certificates into the right place. Ultimately, from a Silverlight perspective, we don't care too much how that certificate got into that trusted publisher store. But once it's there, you know, that's how you get the trust. And then the final step is, yeah, you're not, the strictly speaking, the network administrator is not trusting a specific app. They are trusting apps, all apps that happen to be signed by a specific key. So they're really saying, I trust the Silverlight Insurance Adjuster app. They're saying, I trust applications from Silverlight Insurance because they all carry the same AuthentiCode signature. So we have half a demo so far. We're able to suck files off the /demo directory, which I guess is a start, but it's not really able to access that USB. Or I could hard code it to a different path, but USB drives come on different drives, the different drive letters on different computers. I'd like to be able to detect which drive letter has the USB key, and I'd like to be able to detect when is that key actually inserted. Now, Silverlight doesn't come in with a nice event that says USB drive was just inserted. But using PInvoke, we can write that. And so PInvoke is a way to call native code. You can call raw Win32 APIs using PInvoke. You can also call your own existing native code. If you have a library of existing C or C++ code, PInvoke can let you call it. And just to clarify how this relates to Silverlight 4, in Silverlight 4, we offer COM. COM also lets you call native code. And pretty much anything you can do with COM, or absolutely anything you can do with COM, you can also do with PInvoke. And for the most part, vice versa. Most of what you can do with PInvoke could have been done with COM, but they're optimized for different scenarios. PInvoke is really good for Win32 APIs and native C and C++. COM, on the other hand, is really good for automation APIs. It's late bound. COM doesn't have strong typing like PInvoke does. COM also has registry. You have to put stuff in the registry to register your COM classes. PInvoke doesn't have any of that. So COM is good for Office APIs and other automation APIs, but PInvoke is really the most convenient to use for Win32 APIs and native C and C++ code. And I sometimes get some questions. Why exactly do I want to use the Win32 API? Why do I want native code? And the short answer to that is, don't use it if you don't need it. If you have, the real reason we put this in here is because there's a long tail of operating system functionality that we want you to have access to. Silverlight is download size constrained. It's about 7 megabytes right now. Operating system does not fit in 7 megabytes. Turns out that in that 70 gigabytes or whatever it is, they're able to do a few extra things that we couldn't fit in 7 megabytes. I'm not quite sure how that ever happened, but you know, somehow that factor of 1,000 actually matters. But we want you to have access to those APIs anyway. And so PInvoke is our solution. The stuff that everyone wants to use, if everyone's using an API, we want to make a native Silverlight experience for, or we want to make a managed Silverlight experience, I should say. But the stuff like 3 people in the universe are doing, it's not worth adding to the download size. You know, PInvoke is your friend. PInvoke lets you get outside the bounds of what the Silverlight team has saw fit to wrap. And just one last point here, that COM and PInvoke are available on Windows to trusted apps. You want to use the Win32 API, you have to do it on Windows. And you want to use PInvoke, you have to do it on a trusted app. You can't do trusted stuff from a sandboxed application, because that's equivalent to letting anyone write a web page and take over your hard drive. No one wants that, so trusted apps only. So if you've used PInvoke before, everything I say is going to sound extremely familiar, because PInvoke in Silverlight is exactly the same PInvoke as it is in the .NET framework, to the point that I actually wrote some of my sample code for this app. I actually wrote it first in WinForms, cut, paste into Silverlight, and it worked exactly the same. For those of you who haven't used PInvoke, what you basically do is you provide a declaration of the function you're going to call to C# or VB. There's also a Visual Basic equivalent to this. The magic there is the extern keyword. And the function that we're going to need to use to detect the USB drive is a Win32 function called getDriveType. It'll tell us whether a given drive letter corresponds to a floppy drive, a USB drive, a hard drive, a CD-ROM, a network share. I think there's even one or two other kinds of drives I'd never heard of before in there. And it's a really simple method, though. You define it as being an extern method. That's how you tell C#, hey, I'm going to tell you the parameters, but I'm not going to actually implement this method. The DLL import up there says, look in kernel32.dll for the implementation of getDriveType. And the method has a return type. This particular one is an integer, but it could return pretty much anything. The parameter, again, there's only one parameter for this particular function, but other functions can have more parameters and more complicated parameters. Just a little call out here. This one's actually slightly more complicated than it may look. The C# part of this is a string. The parameter is a string, but if you read Hungarian, you can see right there it's actually a pointer to a character array in native code. And the CLR is smart enough to know that a managed code string maps to a character array in native code, and it'll do the mapping and the marshalling and all that good stuff for you. And so you set up this declaration once, and then from that point on, you just call it like a normal method. Get drive type, pass in your string, it returns an integer, away you go. So let's put that into practice. Let's start off by defining a new class I'll call background USB monitor. And first step here is let's just do all the non-pinvoke stuff first. Just all the normal kind of tasks associated with doing a really nice API. We're going to define a class called background USB monitor. I'm not real creative here. It's going to start. There's a start method that says start your watching. We're going to fork off a new thread so that we're not actually doing our waiting on the main UI thread. You can be doing something else while this thread is busy watching. Once we're done watching, once we've found what we're looking for, we have to get that notification back to the UI thread. And so that's our Silverlight 2 time frame, my favorite little hack there, deployment.current.dispatcher.beginInvoke. All this does is it says, you know, I'd really rather be on the UI thread than a background thread. And it just says, this code is going to be run on the UI thread. So if you start on your background thread, you got to get back to the UI thread to do UI stuff. So this is the stuff that's happening on the background thread. We're just going to make this really simple here. There's just going to be a while loop. We're going to loop over all the drive letters I could think of. Apparently, my computer only goes up to I:. And we're just going to keep looping. There's going to be some magic here that says, you know, we're going to put some pinvoke magic there to detect when we found something. And if we didn't find something, we'll sleep for half a second and try again. Not the world's most complicated implementation. You can do fancier if you want, but I wanted to make this about pinvoke, not about how to program in Win32. But if you're curious, Win32 has a get logical drives command to do basically this stuff here. So the next bit of logic here, let's start filling in this for each. How do we detect? Let's fill it in with the correct thing. Actually, let's go down here and fill in our pinvoke declaration. I think I mismatched my braces here. There we go. All right, so this is exactly the same thing we showed on the slide earlier. Got your magic extern keyword, got your DLL import so C# knows where to look, and our function of the day, getDriveType. So now let's just fill in something here to actually call it. So all we have to do here is just make the call, ordinary method call, and then we got to check the return type against the value that's documented in MSDN. MSDN, the magic number 2, corresponds to drive underscore removable, which is USB for all intents and purposes. I don't remember what the other numbers are, and I don't care because the only thing I care about is USB drives. And then we find that, we fire our UI event. And so now we have our nice background monitor class, but we have to actually use our background monitor class. Otherwise, it's just going to sit there looking pretty. So let's go back to our view model. Inside our damage view loaded method, I'll actually replace it with an alternate implementation of damage view. All we have to do in on damage view loaded is start the monitor. We're going to create our new class, hook up the event handler to a method we got to define in a second, and then start the watching. And then here's the method that actually happens when the USB inserted event happens. We call this GUID. And that's just going to call our old friend add photos from path. USB monitor is going to tell us the path of the USB drive, and then we just pass it to our old friend add photos from path. So let's hit the F5 key there, and I will ceremoniously insert a USB drive. Open that dude, go to our damage report, and here comes the USB. And so it takes a moment for the operating system to detect the insertion of the USB drive, but then once it does, within half a second, as we hard-coded there, up comes the Silverlight stuff. So I wanted to talk for a moment about HTML support. So how many people have ever used HTML? Anyone use HTML around here? Yeah, it turns out it's a pretty handy technology to have. And we want you to be able to reuse your HTML inside your Silverlight apps. It would be kind of a silly place if you had to throw away all your HTML because you wanted to use a little bit of Silverlight. You know, there's more than one reason. It could be that you have existing HTML. Could also be that you have to integrate with HTML content that's not under your control. An outside website, people email you HTML content, you know, whatever, what have you there. Silverlight 4, we have a control called the web browser control, which is based on the web OC. But only out-of-browser apps got to use the web OC. Silverlight 5, we bring the web browser control into the browser. Four browsers that are also based on the web OC, which in today's world is Internet Explorer. We are always on the lookout for ways to extend that to non-web OC browsers, but it's currently based on the web OC. And if you haven't used web browser before, let's just do a real quick demo to see just how easy that is. So we have a nice little news page. One of the, I guess I flew by a little too fast. On the left-hand side, there's a little link for going to a news page. Silverlight insurance adjusters, they always need to stay on top of the latest news, what the latest insurance rates are, vehicle recalls, all that good stuff. But all that good stuff, we have a nice little RSS feed that's based in HTML. Why do I want to rewrite it in Silverlight if I can just reuse the HTML part? And you don't have to. So we'll go down to our display HTML section. This is kind of the idiot-proof version of the demo. And one line of code, we create a web browser. That web browser points to an HTML page. And then the rest of this is just layout stuff. We set the grid row. We set an X colon name just in case. Set horizontal and vertical alignments. And you know all the other usual element stuff you can do to put things where you want. But it's really this one property is kind of the only thing you really need. If you have a web browser without a source, it's a really boring web browser. So always set the source. And you can put source. This particular source is part of our larger application, but you can also deploy it as a separate website. Point off to a separate website, point off to a separate file within your ASP.NET site. Doesn't have to be in the ZAP file. And when we do that, we will see a nice little HTML site. I have no idea what that was. All right. Settings page, or news page, rather. And so this whole white area is the HTML content. And now we get this. This is all HTML. This is off our local page. Let's see if I have network access or not. All right, so this is an external website that we just had a hyperlink to, and you just click that, and the web browser does all the right things and navigates to your HTML content. All right, so there's our web browser. So everything we've talked about so far has been in browser. But we're also working on outer browser. We continue to build up our outer browser experience, and our probably most visible feature there is what we call multiple windows. Silverlight 4, you can have as many windows as you wanted as long as you only wanted one. Silverlight 5, it works exactly the way you expect. There's a window class, you can instantiate them, you can set their height and width, you can set what you put in the window so you don't have an empty window, and you can make them visible. Because again, the invisible windows don't do a lot of good to anyone. So let's try adding multiple windows to our app. And the first step of doing this is to make an outer browser app. Now, we've already done this kind of by accident by virtue of making it a trusted in-browser app. We kind of accidentally made it an outer browser app. But if we hadn't done that already, all we had to do is check this checkbox and make it an outer browser app. And the same application that ran in-browser is now available outer browser. No changes whatsoever. If we made no changes whatsoever, though, we would only get one window. So let's make at least one change. Let's find the logic. Apparently, I beat myself to it. We already have the logic in there on the open click button to do a little bit different when we're running out of browser. So on the open click button, if we're running out of browser, create a new window. Instantiate the window. Instantiate the thing you want to put in the window. Actually, put it in the window. Pick your favorite height and width. You can set a title. One of the other random things that we've done in Silverlight 5 is we've loosened the restrictions around window titles and window positioning. Silverlight 4 had some very strong opinions about where you could put a window and had some very strong opinions that all titles needed to have the URL of the website in that window. We've loosened those from Trusted Apps. We trust you now. We trust you to put the windows where they belong. And then our final step there is, of course, making the window visible. And for our other case, for the in-browser case, let's just keep on doing what we've been doing before, which is to just call, set the navigate URI property and navigate to conceptually the same page. There's incident view, and then there's incident view with background and view box. View boxes are a demo's friend. So let's just do what a usual user would do. They usually start with the in-browser experience. They either right-click or press an install button in the application. Nice little install dialog comes up. They hit install. The application is now launched automatically out of browser. And let's just pop up a couple windows. Window number one, put it over there. And window number two. And now you can see multiple windows side by side and compare those claims against each other to see if there's any commonality between the claims, any suspicious overlap. Apparently, every claim we have was filed by Joe Bob, so we may need to think harder about raising his insurance rates there. So, I talked briefly about this, about the window restrictions on title and placement and size. So 64-bit support. So 64-bit machines are becoming really pretty commonplace. Pretty much any Intel computer you've bought in the last, I'll say, 5 or 6 years has 64-bit hardware on it. It is a 64-bit capable CPU. And the operating systems and the applications are becoming increasingly prevalent as well. Last I checked, Windows 7 was installed in 64-bit mode is a little over 40% of the time. So 40% of the Windows 7 installs are 64-bit operating system, not just 64-bit hardware, but running the operating system in 64-bit mode. Silverlight 5, for the first time, can run in a 64-bit process. And what this means to you is Silverlight 5 can run in a browser that's in 64-bit mode. So Internet Explorer 64-bit requires a 64-bit plugin. If you don't have a 64-bit plugin, you don't get to run in Windows 64-bit. So this is why 64-bit Silverlight is so interesting. Similarly, the sidebar on a 64-bit version of Windows is a 64-bit process and requires 64-bit plugins. So 64-bit, I've had a couple conversations with a couple people that basically go, 64 is cool, it's awesome, I want it. Why do I want it? And the answer to that is going to vary from person to person, but the biggest thing to me is more browsers. Your user can choose either a 32 or 64-bit browser, and they get exactly the same Silverlight experience. You don't have to change your app. It works. Different browser, same experience. The other thing that comes up from time to time is native hosting. If you are writing a native code application that hosts Silverlight inside it, you now have the option of a 64-bit native host. A good example of this is the Office Link team, also known as Office Communicator. They have Silverlight in it, which is interesting. If you work on the Silverlight product and you're constantly tweaking Silverlight, you're also tweaking Communicator by accident. They currently have a 32-bit process, but that's an example of if they wanted a 64-bit process, Silverlight 64 is what they'll need. Final thing there is that 64-bit is great for using a lot of address space. Maybe what I should have said there is it's great for taking advantage of a lot of address space, although it also makes your pointers bigger, so maybe what I said the first time isn't all wrong either. A 32-bit application can access 2 or 3 gigabytes of memory, depending on how the operating system's configured. A 64-bit, it's more memory than we're ever going to see in our lifetimes. It's a lot of memory. Terabytes, petabytes, I forget. So I'm not going to demo that one because the demo is exactly the same app looking exactly the same in a browser that really looks exactly the same as well, but not much of a demo. But here we have a little better of a demo. Shifting gears a little bit, Pivot Viewer. How many people are familiar with Pivot Viewer? All right, a lot of hands. All right, I wasn't expecting that. Pivot Viewer is something that we shipped in June of last year. We shipped it separately from Silverlight. It is a separate download, the V1 of Pivot Viewer. Came in its own SDK. And we got a lot of good feedback about it, and we got a lot of people saying, I like it, but I want to take it to the next level. And so that's what we're doing. We want to take that Pivot experience, which lets you analyze large data sets in a very rich visual way, create interactive graphs. You can filter on the fly, figure out which parts of the data are interesting to you. But we want to bring that to more scenarios, make it easier to build those experiences, and make it easier to plug your data into those kinds of applications. So to do that, 3 big features. We call it dynamic collections. In Pivot 1.0, you pretty much had to define all your data in this kind of funky format, CXML, and yet pretty much either had to do it once or you had to write a big blob of server-side logic to create these CMXML files on the fly. In Silverlight 5, it's just going to be the same way you work with any data in Silverlight. You assign a data context, you assign item source, it populates the thing. So same as a data grid. We also have XAML-based visuals. In the first version of Pivot, the representation of each data point was a bitmap. It was a multi-scale, what's the class called, multi-scale image, the deep zoom. And that was great as long as you had lots and lots of bitmaps. If you didn't have lots of bitmaps, your data wasn't really bitmap-based. It was kind of annoying because you had to create bitmaps. In Silverlight 5, we do XAML-based visuals. You can define your visual in XAML, and even better, you can define different visuals depending on how zoomed in you are. So you can have a really simple view from when you're, you know, seeing the little tiny view of it, and a really complicated view with a lot of information when you're zoomed in real close. And last thing we did was we improved on the customizability. We give you access to the fonts, we give you access to the colors, the sizes, the details that you want to change of your Pivot to make it fit with the look and feel of your application. So let's switch over and check that out. So here we have an insurance-based demo here. Slightly different scenario. After a long week of adjusting insurance, it's Thursday afternoon, and man, I'm already beat. There's one more day in the week, and I'm already exhausted. I'm going to get back to the office, and the first thing I know my boss is going to ask is, dude, Nick, you've been adjusting a lot of insurance. We're paying out a lot of claims. We got to raise our rates. Tell me who we need to raise our rates on. Some of those guys have been getting in a lot of accidents. Some haven't. Tell me who owes us more money. Who are we going to pinch there? So this is a view of all the accidents that have happened in the last 3 or 4 years. And you can see a quick visualization already. Each of these, we call them trading cards, is what we call each of the data points. It has a logo of the car dealer that got in the accident. And it also has a color code telling us how costly the accident was. So our red accidents were really expensive. Green accidents were quite cheap. Yellow accidents, somewhere in between. And each of these data points, we can zoom in. And as we zoom in, we can see we get a different trading card. It swaps in a different set of XAML visuals that gives us additional information as we get closer. And as we get closer still, we can see the same little flattened car look that we had earlier. So we got all this data here. Let's check it out for a moment. We can do nice filtering. We can filter out. Let's just only look at the more expensive accidents. Let's get rid of all that green stuff. We can see where they are. We can put this into a bar chart by dealership. Let's clear this out. And you can already start to see some interesting correlations. These guys get in a lot of accidents of kind of all costs. These guys get in a fair number of accidents, but they're all quite cheap. And these two over here don't get in a lot of accidents, but when they do, watch out, it's going to cost a lot. So already we can start to think about who we're going to be charging more. And we can make that a little bit more clear by getting rid of all the green accidents and stepping it up a little higher and really just focusing on the expensive ones. And apparently, either Javier, Pontiac, or Buick, either they sell really expensive Pontiacs or they really managed to crash those cars hard, because never thought of them as the most expensive accidents. And we also filter by, let's check out panel damage. We can change what we're sorting by. Let's check out which panels of the car were damaged. Let's delete the cost there. And you can see a couple interesting things. One, there's this interesting category called whole car, and I think that probably should be called lazy insurance adjuster if you have a whole car damage. But some of the other categories, again, you can already see the correlation. Front bumper, lot of red. Left quarter, red, but not all that often. Rear bumper, a little bit more mixed. And if you want to focus this down, we can just focus on only the panel damage to the rear bumper, and we can see the distribution of costs. Apparently, we can't see the distribution of costs. So, where's the kill button? Here we go. So, before we go too much further, actually, I was just playing around with that, but I did have a couple things I wanted to show you here. How do we get dynamic data? I haven't really showed you how to get new data into the process. Before we go there, though, let's just see what it takes to get the first data into the process. We have magic properties called data context, and in the XAML, data context is ultimately bound to, drum roll please, item source. So we have, in this page, there's going to be a data context. The pivot viewer control has its item source bound to the data context, really. And that's all we really had to do. We had to get that data from a web service. So this is a callback for a web service. It will then stash away the data in a nice little local property so we can add more stuff to it later. But this is just returning an observable collection that we're going to stash away. Like most good applications, what you get out of the database isn't exactly what you want to show on screen, so we transform the model data into a view model. We pick out which properties we don't want to show. We do the usual view model stuff where property isn't quite formatted the way we want. We want to turn a Boolean into a list or whatnot. Do that stuff. And then we just set over to the data context, and the data context will show up in the item source. And that's how we got the initial data. The additional data works pretty much the same way. If we want to click a button and add twice as much data as we already had some data in the pivot, now we want to add more, do the same thing. Call a web service, do something when the web service completes. And the thing we do is exactly the same. Convert our data into a view model. And then here we iterate over all the new data and we add it to the existing collection. And Pivot is going to be smart enough to add that into the existing collection and even animate it as it comes into play. I'll show that in just a moment. One other thing I want to show here while I have the code open is the various trading cards. So inside our resources for the page, there is a data template for the small view of the trading card. It's a really simple template. It's got a border and an image. We have a medium template. This is the the halfway zoomed in view. It's a little more complicated. And we have a third data template. That's the large template. And by the way, you can actually customize all this. If you have five templates you want, you can have five, you can have 10, you can have one. And you can tell the Pivot viewer what your threshold is as well. Like, when you get to 100 pixels by 100 pixels, I want you to switch to that card, not this card. So that's all configurable as well. And as part of this, in our large template, one thing that I've been missing here is I really would like to know the invoice number for the cars that were crashing up. It'd be interesting to know for a particular accident what the invoice number was, and it'd also be interesting to know if there's any repeats there, see if there's the same car keeps getting crashed multiple times, because then we really want to raise the rates on that. And so that works exactly as you expect. There's a data binding. You just data bind to the text field, put a text block inside the trading card. Text property is data bounds, bunch of layout stuff, and just make sure you delete the comment at the end of the line. And what we're going to see now is that when we zoom into this data, we're going to have that invoice number on the most zoomed in trading card. And so one piece of advice when building these apps at home, if you have images, don't download the entire image for every single car when you start up the app. So one little bit of advice. So as we zoom in, we're going to see that now we have that invoice number there where it wasn't before. And let's zoom out a little bit, zoom in slightly more. One other button, here's our Get New Data button. So we already have our existing set of data. When I press this, additional data is going to fly into the system. And here it's busy downloading all the pictures for all possible cars. But additional data is going to fly in, and Pivot will be smart enough to put it where it belongs. So not all the data was at the end. Looks through the existing sort. It was sorted by dealer. It'll animate it into the correct position for that data. So nice, simple way to do dynamic data with your application. All right, so that pretty much wraps it up. Silverlight 5, if you haven't had it beaten into you yet, Silverlight 5 beta was released this week. Please check it out. We'd love to know what you have to say about it. And Silverlight 5 ships in the second half of this year, so any feedback you give us is great feedback. Any way you can get it to us is good. You can mail it to me. You can watch my blog. I'll post a little bit more about how to do the trusted apps. I'll probably post the this whole code sample will be posted there as soon as we clean it up a little bit. And user voice is another good way to make suggestions for Silverlight features. We do a lot of user voice. There's a user voice website, and go to the Silverlight section, type in the name of your feature, and vote it up or vote it down as you see fit. And so with that, we have time for questions, and thank you all for coming out. And yeah, for questions, microphones in the center here.
The browser in browser, does that work on the Mac?
Question was, does the web browser control work on the Mac? It does for out of browser. It does not do that in browser. We know how to do it for Internet Explorer or for WebOC, which comes with Windows. We would love to work with the browser vendors to make that happen in other browsers, but we're not seeing how to do it at the moment, to be perfectly blunt.
Hi, I'm Victor Larsson from Avanade, Sweden. I have a question regarding the Pivot Viewer. How much can I customize the amount of controls in the viewer? Can I remove controls if I want a mini viewer? I saw a don't panic button. Is that standard in the in the viewer, or am I able to add my own controls to it?
Yeah, so Microsoft has new user usability guidelines. We think don't panic is the way to put into every application. Yeah, that's how you know it's a beta version of software. Yeah, it's not infinite customizability. We give you full control over the trading cards, which are the centerpiece there. We give you partial control over the panel on the left. Let me see if I still have this up. So this panel over here, you basically say which properties and which values you want to put in here. And you also have control over the fonts, the sizes, the colors. But you couldn't, I don't know, turn this panel into a circle, I guess would be an example of something you couldn't do. And then there's this, come on. This little view over here with the get data button, you have control over this part, and that's why we stuck the get data in here, because it was the easiest place to put a get data button.
Do you mind one more question?
Sure.
About the web browser. So the regular web browser control can read PDF files and stuff like that. Could I basically do a website that reads PDF files from other places on the internet?
About PDF files. Honestly, I don't remember where we landed on that. It's the same functionality as we have in Silverlight 4. My recollection was the top level thing needs to navigate to an HTML page, at least as best as Silverlight's able to make sure it's really HTML. But then you can put an iframe inside of that that contains PDF or Word document or whatever else.
I'd like a good excuse not to have to install Adobe products, you know?
Well, we can break it for you then.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Very good session.
Consumer-facing Silverlight apps that are trusted. Is there a workflow that a non-IT person, just a consumer, has a natural way to be able to trust a publisher?
Yeah, so consumer-facing trusted apps. What's the politically correct phrase? I feel your pain. I'll be honest. It is a solution that is designed for those enterprise deployment. There's nothing we did in the technology that requires group policy. There's nothing that requires there to be a network admin. So if you have some other mechanism to set the appropriate registry key, set the appropriate things into the trusted publisher store, that will work. So for instance, if you have a consumer experience where you already have a XE install, you're good to go because your XE can already run the code it needs to do to put that stuff in there. Similarly, if you're already running a Silverlight trusted out-of-browser app, the out-of-browser app is trusted enough to put certificates in there, so that's another possibility for you. But for never visited this website before, never really thought about trusting this publisher before, Silverlight doesn't solve that problem in Silverlight 5.
Thank you.
With the pivot control there, is the aspect ratio set, or can you make it so that when you zoom in, you fold out something, make it double wide? Is that container sizing set?
Is the container sizing set?
So it's a square right now. You zoom in really deep. Can you fold out each trading card so they're double wide to add more detail in terms of the layout?
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Actually, I don't know. I'll have to get back to you on that. If you give me your email address afterwards, I can get you in touch with the pivot experts. Up front.
Does the pinvoke full trust stuff work at all with Macs?
Question was, does pinvoke work on the Mac? Not in Silverlight 5.
Yes. We've had problems in the past. We've used an HTML host control to host HTML content, and we have problems opening a child Silverlight window on top of that. Does the web browser have that issue, opening a child Silverlight window on top of the web browser control?
So what was the original one, the HTML control?
Yeah, we used, I think it was a third-party HTML host control, which was basically an iframe that had the topmost Z index order, and so we had issues of opening a child Silverlight window on top of it.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the HTML control. It's going to have a similar set of problems. The underlying thing you have is that the web browser control is ultimately using the WebOC from the operating system. The operating system WebOC is based on HWINs. It is a separate HWIN from the rest of the content, and that separate HWIN either has to be above the rest of the content or below the rest of the content, and below doesn't make a lot of sense, so it's above everything else. So it, effectively, the web browser control is the highest in the Z order for the Silverlight stuff, except for other web browser controls.
So we'll have to write that fun code that if an element's on top of it, hide the web browser and turn it back on when no control's over it type of approach.
Yeah, you do have what we call airspace problems with a fully interactive web browser control. Now, there is one interesting option for you. There's, in addition to the web browser control, there is the web browser brush. And web browser brush is not interactive, but it can be blended and it has none of the airspace problems. You can fade things over it. It doesn't have to be on top. It can be clipped. You can put it in a circle. You can put it on the background of a text box if you feel like it. So mixing and matching those two can create some really powerful experiences and some powerful animations.
Thank you.
Can the hosted web browser have methods like navigate to string for generated HTML?
Does the hosted web browser control have methods like navigate to string? It does have methods. I'm trying to remember the exact name of it. There's a method that says navigate to something, and there's two varieties of it, one of which takes a URL and another of which takes HTML. I'm blanking on the name of it, though.
Hi. I'm curious about the threading model of windows. So let's say that you have two different windows and you want to communicate between them. Do they have their own dispatchers, and how do they intercommunicate?
So the question is about threading model for windows. All the windows share the same thread. It's exactly like a WinForms app. The easy way to write a WinForms app is you have five different windows. They are all using the same, they don't call it a dispatcher in WinForms, but it's the same concept. They all use the same message loop. If one of them blocks, they all block. And the advantage of that is that if one of them has something to say to the other, there's no synchronization needed. You just send data. It does the right thing. You just call code, and there's no threading magic to think about when you want to communicate between your two different windows.
Also, a comment about the API of Windows. I think as a traditional programmer, I would expect like a show method rather than a property to be set.
Okay. I laugh because we've heard that feedback internally quite a bit, and that's great feedback.
Thank you.
All right, we have one more in the back here.
Yeah, can I just have a quick follow-up on that? In a trading application, sort of the background to this, if I had another window and that window had a web browser control and that web page had a Silverlight plugin, is that valid to create a separate space so that I can run into my own?
So let's see if I got this straight. You have Silverlight that contains HTML that contains more Silverlight?
Silverlight app, another window, right? Okay. So multi-window. That window has a web browser control. The web page has a Silverlight plugin. Am I in a separate thread now, and can I run somewhat independently for high streaming data?
Where did the windows come from? Are they browser
parent
windows?
No, it's a parent Silverlight application. I do the new window piece, the multi-window you're enabling now, right? My other window, if I put a web browser control, can that host a Silverlight plugin? Is that valid in a web browser control?
So it is valid for a web browser control to contain Silverlight itself.
Yes.
Yeah, you can do that. I don't know what level of depth we do. We do actually test that recursive scenario.
But that would give me a separate network stack, client stack. That's kind of what I'm trying to get at there.
It will give you a separate app domain. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think about which browsers spawn new processes for that scenario.
Yeah.
That's really a browser decision when to choose to fork a new process for browsing purposes.
Yeah.
I don't think they do today. I don't think the WebOC does fork a new process. So I think that would all be running in the same process.
So I'd only end up with the four connections if I use the client stack, probably in an aggregate.
Yeah, and so in terms of there's parts of the client stack that are basically in managed code. Mm-hmm. So there's the in-memory cookie store for the client HTTP stack. And that's going to be a per app domain thing. So if you have two different Zaps,
yep,
they're going to be running in two different app domains, and they're going to have two different in-memory cookie stores.
Perfect. Thank you. I'll test it.
All right. Thank you very much, and I hope you guys have a great flight back.